This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start today with a story from the September 1985 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Little Friends by Richard Mueller. Captain Tasio had no interest in anything out of the ordinary unless it interfered directly with either the mission or his love life. I couldn't blame him. We were running a big mission in those days, what with the stepped-up strikes on German war industries, the heavy losses over the subpens, and the teething problems on the new G models, and the pressure. We just completed our 23rd mission on the Miss Lydia. Two more, and we'd be rotated home, and Charlie Howell had made lead bombardier, which bumped Tasio up to even more responsibility. It was a big job for a 25-year-old kid, and I didn't envy him. Naturally, Tasio played hard. There was talk that he had a woman in London and one in Molesworth, our base's host town. Didn't surprise me. He had those boyish, dark, Italian good looks. He could have probably talked himself under any skirt in England. That he restrained himself to two was remarkable enough, but, like I say, he took his job seriously. I was the odd wheel on the crew. At 30, they called me Pops, or Teach. The war had rescued me from the doldrums of the Brattleboro grade school system, and I was sort of the crew's Dutch uncle. Not surprising either. I had 5 years on the oldest of them, Tasio. I flew the number 2 seat on the Miss Lydia, and as long as Tasio functioned, my duties consisted primarily of backup. I spelled Tasio on the long routine stretches between attacks. I coordinated fighter defense. I helped patch up the wounded. I was reserve, radio man, bombardier, engine, gunner, and I was morale officer. Not by choice. By Tasio. Hey, Pops, I need a new chute. Teach, can you swing us a lead? Lieutenant, I gotta see the chaplain. But I didn't much mind. It made the time more interesting, and I was learning the service from the ground up. I figured that by the end of the war, I would know enough to start my own Air Corps, and it was a good listen in when to say no. But not to Tasio. Rank hath. Chick, can you talk to him? Tasio always called me Chick, never Pops or Teach. I guess it made him feel older. Or maybe, being a New Yorker, he just didn't want to grant that much deference to an Englander. Yes, Captain. Please, Tony, after all. Uh-oh. Tasio was predictable. This meant trouble. I had made arrangements to run up to London to catch a show, Man and Superman. Then, late dinner with a cousin serving on First Army staff. I needed to get away, but Tasio obviously had other ideas. He favored me with a disgustingly disarming smile. What do you want, Captain? Will you talk to Bozeman before you leave? I'm kinda worried about him. Then why don't you talk to him? What's his problem? I think he may be getting a little sky happy. Mickey Keller said Bozeman thinks he's been seeing things. What kind of things? I don't know. He didn't say. Why doesn't he see the shrink? Send him up to London for a day. Let him look at a few ink blocks. It'll make him feel better. That's what Mickey told him, but Bozeman said no. He thinks he's fine. They always do. Bozeman was either crazy or faking, and faking sharp enough to not act like he thought he was crazy. But that wasn't Bozeman's style. He was Gulf, Texas, happy to be here, liked his job. He was a good radio man, lousy gunner, and never caused any trouble. Typical career Air Corps, if he survived, and with luck he would. In 23 trips with Tony Tasio, we'd lost only 3 killed and 3 wounded. That was another reason I tolerated Tasio. He was a damned good pilot. Okay, I'll see him. Thanks, Chick, I owe you. Thanks, Tony, that makes about 800 you owe me. So I trotted across to the crew's barracks to look up Johnny Ray Bozeman. Bozeman roomed with Mickey Keller, and Mickey was up to London. We were off the line for 2 days, and most of the crew had scattered far and wide. Not Bozeman. He was sitting on his bunk reading a book when I entered. The door was open. I knocked on the jamb. Bozeman was a big blonde farm kid, all lanky mass, but with small hands and long fingers. Perfect radio man hands. He saw me and started to get up, but I waved him down. At ease, Johnny. Can I come in?
Sure, Lieutenant.
I perched on the foot of the bed. Bozeman noticed my leave regs. Going up to London, sir?
Yep.
How about you? Planning on seeing the sights before we cycle out again?
Nah. Gonna read.
May I? He handed the book over somewhat reluctantly. It was a hardbound and not a library book either. That meant it was a gift, or Bozeman had bought it. I read the spine, Spirit Phenomena of the Heights by G.W. Lancaster. Bozeman accepted it back guiltily.
Interesting?
Yes, sir.
Ghost stories?
No, sir. I tried a new tack. You happy here, Johnny?
Yes, sir, Lieutenant, he said earnestly. I like it fine.
Sure beats Graves registration.
Standard ugly joke.
Wash out anywhere and you wind up in Tunisia, collecting dog tabs and planting corpses.
Sure does. No problems then?
He set down the book and fixed me with an intensely serious expression that he'd obviously seen in a movie. I restrained myself from laughing.
Lieutenant, I'm happy to be here and proud to be doing my job, winning this war for America.
I gave up and caught the late train.
I forgot about Bozeman.
Over the next 2 days, I got Noblet's teeth fixed, told Berman that his brother had been killed on Rendova. Berman didn't seem to care, and I filed that information away, keep an eye on him, and told Keller to write to his family more often. I'd missed the play the night I'd had my useless talk with Bozeman, and my cousin, a 27-year-old major, had made me feel like a family failure. Tom's a captain. Jim won the Silver Star. You like being a co-pilot? I wrote off the leave and got ready for the next round of hell. 24 was a run on the subpens at Lorient. Nasty work. Heavy flak and almost no chance of doing any damage to the subs, safe under yards of concrete. And fighters, 190s, 110s, 109s, and our formation just loose enough to let them in. It was all I could do to keep them on top of the brawl. Keller, top turret. 2 110s coming in, 130 high. Howells, nose turret. I'm on him. Me, track him. Don't fire into the wing ship. Tail, watch for a 12 o'clock low pass under.
Noblet, tail guns.
There goes the 40 ship. Got a 110 at 6 o'clock now. He'll have to veer.
Me,
Smith, heads up.
Smith, ball turret.
Got him. Pass on the port side. Like that, but faster. I listened, watched for anything ahead, and directed the gunners on to stray bandits that might break through. We'd beaten off the first attack with 2 losses and no hits on the Lydia, and things were back to normal when Bozeman screamed, "There they are! I see 'em!" I could hear turrets grinding in the intercom.
"Where?" I cried.
"Report!"
10:30 high.
No, not fighters, them.
Tazio and I automatically looked forward the port, forward quadrant. There was nothing but clouds.
Tazio covered his mic.
I thought you said he was okay.
I never said that. I said I couldn't find out what was wrong.
Tazio gave me a dirty look.
Bozeman, this is Tazio. Shut up. What's out there?
There was a chatter of crew crosstalk, but no Bozeman.
Bozeman?
Keller came on the line.
Captain, he won't say.
He's okay. He's,
I don't know.
Damn it. Keep your heads up and don't fuck around.
Tazio was a grim SOB for the rest of the flight, which included a smashed Norden, bombs off target, a shredded aileron, and $1 million hole in the butt for John Noblet.
What do you mean you talk to him?
You're his skipper. He went nuts up there. Bench him. Put him in the shrink line.
Tazio threw the file on his desk.
He's also a crack radio operator.
Cracked, you mean. Shut up, Henderson. We stared at each other. I counted to 10, avoiding the court-martial I knew would come from my next word. Tazio refused to soften. I'm not shipping Bozeman out with one mission to go and getting some snot-nosed kid straight out of Kansas. Johnny'll just get assigned to another crew and maybe killed, and we'll have to fly the big one with a bum radio man. I don't want that, especially now. My ears lifted. You heard something? He shook his head, then stopped. He put a hand on my shoulder, but I was too tight to push it away. You heard something? He nodded. Deal? Talk. I tell you, you talk to Bozeman. You bastard, sir. Tazio grinned. Where? The factory's at Ham. Mother of God. I didn't have the slightest idea on how to approach it, so I fell back on rank. It made me feel shitty and stupid, but I was worried about Ham. The flak was the least of it. Several hours without our little friends and the fighters would be hell. Sour oxygen, freezing air, stay-up pills, noise, bloodshed. 3 out of every 10 planes would likely be hit and hit badly. Half of them wouldn't come back. But if we did, it was rotation home. I could almost smell Vermont. Bozeman was going to get his shit together and fast, or I'd bench him with a broken jaw. I collected him, and we took a walk out to the flight line. He knew he was in trouble, and I didn't want to give him the time to build a story, so I got right to it. Educated guess. What did you see over Lorient? He stopped, hung his head. Lieutenant, you won't believe me. Bingo. Try me. Oh, sir. Bozeman, you talk now, or you'll spend rotation tour in the psychiatric hospital, understand? He nodded. Then he began to talk, slowly at first, then with a rush like a collapsing dam. I started seeing them on my first tour, just a few times, like little lights in the clouds, only once or twice, and way off. And they weren't planes. I know planes. I've seen more planes in the last year than I want to think about. Ours, theirs, Limey's. I can tell a 190 from a 109 by the engine noise on the other side of the formation. I've never fired on one of ours by accident. You try me with the spotter cards, I'm good. But these were lights, little lights, moving fast. I'd guess about 600-700 miles an hour, and that's on the climb. And right turns, Lieutenant, like a weasel down a gopher hole. No, sir, they weren't planes. Have you talked to anyone else? No, sir. And I listened a lot at the USO, the EM clubs, to other guys talking, but I never heard anyone talk about anything like it, so I just waited. I watched. I figured they weren't hurting me none, and with the Jerrys, I got enough trouble up there. Then, you remember Romilly SS? I nodded. Romilly Sur Seine, the Dewoitine aircraft plant. Our third mission, and a real killer. We'd lost our ball turret gunner, blown right out of the plane, and 3 wounded seriously. Tim Benson had come back with 1 hand and 1 foot. 1 shell, murder. Well, during the battle, I was running the radio room gun and trying to keep from shooting off the tail. I know I'm not too good on the 50s, but I did hit a 190 that day. And you saw the lights? Yes, sir. 3 of them. And I heard them, too. I stopped. We were standing beneath the hulking wing of a 17, the Jock of Hearts, Tom Hanicutt's ship. You heard them? Yes, sir. On my headset. Your headset? On the radio? He shook his head earnestly. On the intercom channel, Lieutenant, I could hear their voices. Could you have been mistaken? Bozeman was starting to give me the creeps. No, sir. They weren't speaking English. It was a foreign language and none I've heard before. It wasn't German and it sure wasn't French. A little like Japanese, he shrugged, or like what I guess Japanese would sound like. I haven't heard much of it. Anyway, it was real fast, like speeding up a record, and when the lights went away, I didn't hear it anymore. That's when I started seeing a mentalist. I groaned. A mentalist. Seances and science of mind nonsense. England seemed to be full of them that season, real ones and phony ones, or phony ones and phonier ones. Everyone wanted to know when the war would end, and when their Alf would come home, and there were plenty of men and women about willing to pick up a fast buck for telling them. But Bozeman knew just what I was thinking. "Relax, sir. I didn't tell him anything he couldn't have read in the papers, and he didn't ask. But he put me on to the spirits in the Heights." He looked at me. I just waited for him to go on. "Well, sir, a lot of people believed for a long time that there are things that live in the air, intelligent things that live there like we live on the ground. Does any of this make sense, Lieutenant?" "It did in an odd way. I read a lot, Johnny. When I was a kid, I read a story by Arthur Conan Doyle called The Horror of the Heights. It gave me a real chill, like I'm feeling now," I thought. Bozeman nodded. "I read it, Mr. Hubert. The mentalist gave it to me to read. But it's not like that. They're friendly, or at least not evil like in the story. They're just watching." He grinned shyly. "Too bad we can't get them on our side, huh, Lieutenant? Like our little friends, the fighters." "Yeah." I was stumped. He believed it completely, and nothing I could do would shake him. Nothing I could say would make the slightest bit of difference. I could only try to pave it over and hope we could get past Ham. Then we could go home. Then we would be safe. "Johnny?" "Yes, sir." "Johnny, I'm going to tell you something, and in return, you're going to do something for me, okay?" "Sir?" "You don't agree, and I can see that you spend the rest of the war in the hospital. You want that?" I knew that some men would prefer that easy way out, but not Johnny Ray Bozeman. "No, sir. I'll do whatever you like." "Good, Johnny. We're going in deep tomorrow. Ham, I think. We're going to have to be on our toes if we want to come back, and I want to come back. You know what that means. Rotation home." "Right. So you don't say anything about your lights. You man your radio and your gun, and we all come back, and we all go home. Okay?" After a moment, he nodded. "Get some sleep," I said, and walked away. Lead ship takes the flak. Lead ship gets the fighters. By the time we pulled away from the target, we'd gotten both. Brownstein, the replacement gunner for Norbit, was dead. Tazewell went back to cover the tail. Charlie Howells was bleeding from a leg wound. Port flap was jammed. 3/4 of the ammo gone. Ball turret stuck, like rafts ruined. Windshield smashed. The oxygen lines had been shot away, and we'd been forced to drop out of formation to bring her down to where we could breathe. It was more dangerous flying alone, but perhaps they wouldn't be looking for a single plane running low. The wind whistled through the cockpit. Tony Tazio and I were both bleeding from perspex fragments, but we were alive. Tazio looked at me. His grin was tired, but nothing could throw Don Juan for long. "Rough trip." "Yeah, too bad about the new kid," I said. He nodded. "This is going to sound crude, Chick, but I'd rather it was him than one of us." No argument. He banked us towards the Dutch coast. I watched trees and farms fly by below, the rushing air burning my face. At least it was no longer freezing cold. "Chick, thanks again for talking to Bozeman. I guess he's okay." "Yeah," I glared at him. "Ham, huh? You said we were going to Ham, not Kiel. Not the goddamn subpens at Kiel." Tazio shrugged. "So I got some wrong info. No harm done, right? Tell that to Brownstein." "You knowing about Kiel wouldn't have made squat to Brownstein," Tony said logically. "He'd still be dead. And I said, thank you. What more do you want? You want to fly the plane?" "No, I don't want to fly the damned plane." "Hey, talk nice about her. She's named for my sister, you know." "I know, I know." I actually saw it before I heard it. A blur that crossed my vision. The holes opening the cockpit wall. Smashed and flying instruments, sound following. "Fighters," I screamed into the mic. "Get on it, Tony, bank." But the shots that had missed me had torn off Tony Tazio's handsome jaw and blown open his chest. I saw his heart pumping redly before he collapsed forward onto the controls. Miss Lydia lurched and heeled into a clumsy dive. I screamed and tore Tazio loose from the stick, struggling to unstrap him, push his body out of the seat as his blood spattered me. The Dutch countryside rushed upwards. "Crew, report!" Tazio tumbled into the aisle as I pulled her out, tearing across the fields at 1,000 feet. "Report, damn it!" They called in, one by one. It was worse than I thought. Bow, Ball, and Top Terrets out. Keller dead, 3 wounded, and Tazio. What hit us? 190s, 2 of them. Heads up. I'm going down on the deck so they can't get under us. Watch for 'em. I knew they'd hit us again. We were too good a target. They'd come at us from the starboard side, 130 level, which meant they were somewhere off to the port side, circling, probably ahead of us with their greater speed. Then they'd hit us from the front, smash the engines and me, and we had no functioning bow guns. I banked right, hoping to give the cheek or waist guns a shot. "Lieutenant, they're here." The voice was strained, scared. I couldn't blame him. I was well over the edge myself. "Where, Bozeman?" "In the radio." "Not the fighters, them." "Bozeman, shut up, damn it, not now. Get on a gun, any gun." We flashed over a village, laid out between intersecting canals, the light flak winking, too late to hit us. I twisted about frantically, searching for the fighters. They'd come in at 10:30 high, or 12 o'clock if they could manage it. A flash of lights. Bozeman? No. The sun on Perspex. 2 of them, coming in leisurely, taking their time. "Heads up, 10:30 high. Cheek and waist. Get ready. Lieutenant, not now." The specks leveled out slowly. They drifted right to come ahead of us. I strained to bring Miss Lydia around, a wounded, lumbering elephant. The fighters were fast, but if I could just bring our guns to bear. "Little friends, please, please help us now." "Bozeman," Howells called, "there's none of our fighters out this far. Please." The 190s drifted in front of me, lazily, taking their time. They would line me up and shoot when they couldn't miss. I watched them grow larger and larger, waiting for the little lights of their wing guns. "Please, please, here they come," I said foolishly. And then the right-hand 190 flew apart, wings spinning high and wide, the propeller diving lazily towards the fields. The other slewed wildly to the left, trying to escape, but its tail fell off as if a vast, invisible blade had dropped through it. It paused, then, firing its guns in a last defiant act, it plunged into the earth. "Lieutenant? Captain? What happened?" "The fighters, they're gone." "What?" "Gone. Just gone." And in the background, I could hear Bozeman's soft voice repeating over and over, "Thank you. Thank you, little friends. Thank you." They patched me up and shipped me back to Wright Field to start in the new B-29 program. With Miss Lydia shot to pieces and 3 out of 10 dead, they broke up the crew, some to training, some to leave, then back to England. I lost touch almost immediately. I suppose that's war. But when I hit the States, I did right. The answers came back, some of them, and finally, a letter from England from a doctor explaining Bozeman's condition, his delusions, asking me if I had any information. But I know what they say if I told them, so I can't. There's no way I can help, nothing I can do, but I wish I could. Please. We continue with a story from the January 1986 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is State of the Art by Robert Charles Wilson. It was the eyes that attracted him first. They sat in the window of the ocular shop, nestled on velvet, protein-compatible nerve conduits dangling behind. The eyes were a polished silver, so reflective that they seemed to contain the world, and the irises were icy blue disks. Rogan thought about the eyes during the long drive home. They were Bausch & Lomb full-spectrum day and nighters. The price, printed on a discreet white tag, was outrageous. "More than outrageous," Margaret said when, tentatively, he raised the subject. "You don't need such a thing. You do okay." Once, she had been beautiful. Rogan knew that many men, the fortunate ones, think their wives are beautiful, but of Margaret it was an objective, demonstrable truth. Because she was shy, she had refused to enter the Queen of Classics department competition when they were in college, but she would have won. Everybody said so. Her hair had been long and full and blonde. Her skin was china pale, her features fine, her eyes a delicate brown. Her smile had been like flash bulbs going off. And the truth was that she was still good-looking, Rogan thought. But time had fretted at her as it had fretted at him, and they were both looking a little worn. "I'm tired of the contact lenses," he said. "So get new ones, but not this." Really, it didn't make any sense. He said a last hopeless salvo. "If we put off the new car for a while, Ben, you want that car. You said so." So he put the day and nighters out of his mind. In the morning, he walked past the ocular shop, between the parking lot and the office where he worked, with a stern and willful disinterest. The eyes gazed back at him from the window, balefully. Rogan was a data block ordinator. He sat at a terminal all day, monitoring the flow and exchange of information between his employer's corporate mainframe and all the other mainframes and data banks it accessed. These were displayed on his CRT as building blocks of various sizes and color. Rogan's job was to make sure they meshed and separated in the right sequence. He was something like an air traffic controller. Usually, everything was okay. When it wasn't, he had to investigate and sort things out, tapping madly at his keyboard while the terminal howled and blinked. This happened maybe once a day. Today, however, there was nothing, and Rogan grew bored watching the colored blocks stack and unstack themselves on the screen. He was pleased when his afternoon relief, a tall and athletic man named Forster, came in and hung his coat on the peg. Rogan wanted desperately to get away. "Whenever you're ready," Forster said. "It's all yours," Rogan said. "Thank God." He stood up, he stretched, he turned. The breath seemed to catch in his throat. "Something wrong?" Forster asked. "No," Rogan said. "No, nothing at all." Forster stared at him, the silvery orbs of his eyes catching the fluorescent light, and for a moment Rogan saw his own reflection there. "The physical attraction takes only a short time," the ocularist explained. "The nerve glues, the muscle sealants are very fast acting. You'll be operational 20 minutes after you come out of surgery. No, the time for taking time is now, while you have the choice." The sheer number of eyes in the shop daunted him. The display occupied an entire wall. Some of the Japanese manufactured units were mounted in pale mannequin faces, where they twitched back and forth as if in the throes of a mute and terrible panic. Some were silver, like Forster's. Some were tinted a deep, compelling blue. Several were translucent, and he could see the tiny machinery inside, like camera lenses in aspic. Rogan felt dizzy. He began to perspire. Maybe this wasn't such a wise idea after all. Maybe Margaret was right. "The best ones," Rogan said helplessly. "Which are the best ones?" "Depends," the ocularist said. "Do you have a special application in mind? Do you scuba dive, hunt animals at night, practice astronomy as a hobby?" "No," Rogan said. "I just want a good all-rounder," the ocularist supplied. "The best all-rounder," he tried to sound firm. The ocularist went to the window display and lifted the velvet-lined pedestal with the Bausch & Lomb's on it. He put them on a glass-topped counter for Rogan to admire, stepping back as Rogan bent closer, smiling distantly. Shake them, he suggested. No telltale rattle of cheap machinery there. Should I? I'm not sure. They don't take fingerprints, the ocularist sniffed, and they're not fragile. Rogan picked one up. It was firm and cool to the touch. The embedded iris glittered like an exotic gem. But the price, he said regretfully. Ah, the ocularist said. His manner became stiff, formal. He drew away the Bausch and Lomb's. We do, of course, offer other lines. He took a blank box from beneath the counter. Inside, two fishy white eyes lay on a bed of tissue paper. Rogan reached half-heartedly to touch them. Careful now, the ocularist said. Rogan sighed. It's all right. I'll take the Bausch and Lomb's. The intelligent choice, I think. We can arrange financing, and we offer a generous trade-in value on your unwanted biologicals. My what? Your eyes, the ocularist said. He left work early on the day that had been arranged. The entire process, including the time spent blindfolded while muscles knitted and the anesthetic wore off, took less than 3 hours. The first thing Rogan noticed when his new eyes were unbandaged was that the winter light beyond the window had failed. But I can see, he marveled. I can read. My God, I can read the billboard at Bay Street, 5 city blocks away. It was an ad for synthetic meat at night. The ocularist sat impassive in his surgical whites, making notations on a clipboard. He had a medical technician's degree framed and hung on the wall of his inner office. Rogan amused himself by deciphering the Latinate fine print. Everything moves, the ocularist said, up, down, side to side. Yes. He picked up Rogan's eyelids and pressed an ophthalmoscope against his orbits. No blind spots? Everything seems lucid? Yes, he added. They feel a bit raw, a kind of pressure. It fades in time. It had faded, in fact, by the time Rogan arrived home. He had not told Margaret about the Bausch and Lomb's. He wanted to present her with a fait accompli. Now, riding the elevator up to their condo, he felt a knot of anxiety in his stomach. How would she react? The surprising thing was that she did not react. Oh, there was a moment after he had kissed her when she looked at him seriously for a time, and he knew she must have noticed. His eyes were silvery bright and touched with cornflower blue where before they had been merely bloodshot and watery. But she didn't remark on it. She tied back her apron and said dinner would be ready in a minute. Synthetic chicken, she said. Rogan went into the bathroom to admire his new eyes. What he saw was gratifying. His face had always seemed somehow weak when he was forced to confront it in the mornings, frothing with toothpaste. Now, although his chin had not been noticeably firmed, nor his sagging jowls tightened, he saw a face that was cool, aloof, almost threatening. A thrill ran through him. She didn't react, Rogan thought, because she loves me. She had accepted his decision. Anyway, it was too late to fight it. His old eyes had probably been auctioned off to some charity hospital in Equatorial Africa. He respected her choice by making no comment of his own, except about the chicken, which he said was good. The real test came later. They made love. It was awkward at first. Rogan felt embarrassed by his eyes, or rather was afraid they would embarrass Margaret. He kept them closed. Then, when her passion had begun to build, he allowed himself to look closely at her. There was none of the revulsion he had expected to see. He was pleased. The pace picked up. He began to stare boldly. She said she loved him. Rogan murmured that he loved her too, but now his new eyes were having an unsettling effect. He saw Margaret's face, although the room was dark, with an almost hallucinogenic clarity, saw the wrinkles that had begun to creep out from her eyelids, the faintly cracked skin of her mouth. The flesh between the ear and her collarbone was pale and finely skeined. The Bausch & Lomb's made it a topography of ancient river valleys. He closed his eyes and thought about the way she used to look. He went to work in the morning, eager for his next encounter with the relief man, Forster. It was a difficult day. There were 3 consecutive data collisions, each requiring an extensive and elaborate debugging. But the time passed. He stood up promptly when he heard Forster come. The younger man gazed impassively at Rogan's new eyes. B&L's, he said finally. Very impressive. Rogan was pleased. Forster's eyes had come from one of the big Sino-Japanese cartels. Rogan was able to discern the trademark characters incised into the silver. Take that, he thought, you son of a bitch. Thanks, he said modestly. Hearts, Forster said. His smile was enigmatic. Rogan said, what? Hearts, kidneys, lungs, the vital organs. He nudged Rogan painfully in the ribs. That's where the real action is. A complete internal revision is a complex procedure. It takes time. The price, naturally, reflects this fact. Rogan had gone not to a sidewalk ocularist this time, but to Hills and Rutherford, the most prestigious of the city's replacement agencies. The showroom was a shag-carpeted and wood-paneled chamber high in an office tower. The salesman was poised and tailored, and his glittering eyes bore down on Rogan's own. Rogan felt inadequate in this setting, almost shabby, but he was captivated by the stock. An artificial heart in a glass case flushed rose-tinted water through translucent tubing. The motion was smooth, effortless, and quiet as a whisper. Kidneys were racked against one wall like colorful coral growths. Boa-like ropes of intestine reclined on pegs. The effect, Rogan thought, was somehow tropical. 2, the salesman was saying, one inevitably pays a premium for quality. What we sell here, he passed Rogan a stainless steel thigh bone, is state-of-the-art in prosthetic technology. He did not doubt it. I assume there'll be a reasonable exchange value on my parts. Well, the salesman cocked one eyebrow in the attitude of the connoisseur or the careful shopper. We'll do what we can, of course. Rogan figured he could take out a second mortgage. Margaret accepted the change graciously, and she was resigned to the financial reversal. After all, he still had his job. She took day work at a software store, but Rogan could not convince her that she too should make the change. Take a good look, he said. Am I any different, really? Am I? Not on the outside, she said. They had argued. She had cried. Her eyes were still puffy and red. But it's better, Rogan said. It really is. I don't wake up in the middle of the night thinking, Jesus, I'm not a kid anymore. What about a coronary? What about kidney disease? What about my lungs? I could smoke if I wanted to. Tobacco. I can eat anything. I could eat a goddamn chair. Is that so important? You bet it is. She seemed to soften. It's all right for you, Ben. I understand. It's how you are. But I don't want to change in that way. And I don't understand why you want me to. It was a tricky question. A part of him wanted to say, because you'll feel better, you'll feel younger, and we'll be together in this thing. That would have been okay, but another part of him wanted to say, because you've aged, because you're not young and good-looking anymore, and because I'm increasingly disgusted at how primitive and biological you are. He hated the idea of her blood gushing through fleshy arteries, clogged with the debris of a high cholesterol diet, of the webwork of nerve and muscle, the pulsating animal processes. He had been like that once. Now he was cleaner, sleeker, better. He had replaced almost all of his internal organs, and the replacements, though regrettably hidden, carried all the best trademarks. Consider doing it for me, Rogan said. You still love me, don't you? Of course I do. She had become very serious. Ben, I loved you before any of this. I loved you when you were a fat, middle-aged man with ordinary eyes. It was flattering, of course, but he couldn't bring himself to believe it. How unfair it was. He had given her, finally, something worthy of love. Why couldn't she hold up her end of the bargain? I used to put my head on your chest, she said mournfully. When you were sleeping, I'd listen to your heart beating. It was reassuring, a good sound. Now, she sighed, all I see is a sound like the wind in the trees. His new body and his new eyes made him feel hyper-confident at work. It was as if he could see the data collisions stacking up before they happened. By the time the red light started to flash, he'd be all the way into the mainframe, ready, troubleshooting like crazy. He got a special commendation on the winter efficiency report. Forster came in one dark afternoon, shaking snow off his top coat. It's a bitch out there. I'll bet, Rogan said, but his eyes were on the screen. He was finishing off a heavy bug route. The data blocks were gliding now, slick as ice. Brought you coffee, Forster said. He placed the cup on Rogan's desk. Rogan stared. Forster's arm was sleep-burnished aluminum. The fingers were slim and agile. Servo motors hummed like the sound of different cicadas. There was the heady aroma of warm machine oil. Thanks, Rogan said faintly. What you have in mind, the sales rep at Hills and Rutherford said, is possible. Yes, it's even been done to a few people, a few places, but the cost. I don't care, Rogan said. He felt at home in the showroom now, at ease. He felt worthy of the fine things displayed around him. He felt, in an important way, part of them. You don't understand, the salesman said. We're not talking about a price that's merely high. High is inadequate. We're talking, he spread his hands, exalted. I realize that. We know a little bit about you, Mr. Rogan. We make it a policy to be informed about our customers. And your credit rating is good, but not that good. Even if you disposed of your property, liquidated your assets, even with the trade-in on what you've already purchased from us, there must be a way. The salesman looked at him for a time. Finally, he said, perhaps. Good, Rogan said. Perhaps. You don't understand the strictures. It would mean leaving your job. It would mean, shall we say, a radically altered lifestyle. Are you prepared to deal with that? Yes, Rogan said. I don't care. Ah, well then. There was the shadow of a smile. He's working on commission, Rogan thought. Hills and Rutherford, you see, is a wholly owned subsidiary of Loomis Technology and Resources. Our parent corporation has a model contract it offers in situations such as this. It's basically a question of reciprocity. He did not accept at once. He felt he owed that much, at least, to Margaret. She stared at him. He saw, involuntarily, the yellow residue that had accumulated at the inner angles of her eyes. Her skin was pale and porous. She was sweating. You'll hardly be human, he blinked. That's a phylocentric attitude. I'll be the same old Ben. It's me, isn't it? It's because I've changed. No, he said. This is what I want, he nodded. You could have it too. There was a time when I was what you wanted, me, just me. I guess it was because I was young, pretty, the best you could get. Now I'm what? Obsolete? God, I feel so old. She began to weep. Rogan turned away. None of this mattered. He felt hard, cold, shiny. He knew what he wanted. He had perhaps overlooked certain clauses and considerations in the contract, duration, obligation, and matters of configuration, but all in all, he was pleased with the results. The parts of himself he could see were sleek, efficient, and ruthlessly functional. They shipped him to an island called Nunavak, and he descended under his own power to the Loomis T&R mines along the steep submerged slope of the Bering Sea. It was a strange, lifeless place, and the job he did was repetitive, manipulating slags of ore-bearing rock, which reminded him of enormous chunks of incoming data in his beryllium claws. But there were others like him there, with whom he could communicate by means of sonar signals and flashing lights, and he reminded himself that he was the newest and shiniest of them all. Some, the older ones, had tarnish crawling across their carapaces like a strange disease. Not him. He was functional. He was clean. The years passed, however, and Rogan was as susceptible to the vulgar work of entropy as the rest. There came a time when he was slow and barnacled, and his joints were prone to seizure, when he began to doubt the wisdom of the enterprise, to think with some nostalgia of the way he had been before all this. It was a temporary malaise. It entered when the new dredger was introduced to the mines. Her name was inscribed across her prow. Rogan's eyes, though they were failing, deciphered it through the frigid gloom. He scuttled forward, crab-like, wanting to weep, although he could not, crying out her name across the sonar frequencies. Margaret! Margaret! She was lovely, all gleaming silver and sealed ball joints. She was state of the art, and she was his. We conclude with a story from the July 1985 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is The God Machine by Damon Knight. Not a good morning. Bunny is on the rampage again. Three people in the art department are out with AIDS, heavy smog. At 10 o'clock, Terry is calling into Ollie's office. Terry is the creative director. Ollie is the president, handlebar mustache, striped t-shirt, Adidas. Besides Ollie's desk sits a little man with a suitcase in his lap, plastic suitcase, undistinguished haircut. Terry, says Ollie, I want you to meet Bill Sontag. He's here to show us the marketing miracle of 1985. The client is Universal Electric. They want a presentation for a 30-mil all-media campaign starting in September. What is the product, Bill? Terry inquires. It's like God in a box, says Bill. How's that for a slogan? Asks Ollie, popping a pill. Not bad, eh, Terry? Terrific, just terrific, Ollie. What does it do? I'm going to let Bill explain that. Take him back to your office, and Terry, lock your door. They go to Terry's office. Terry moves a teddy bear to make room for Bill to sit down. What is your position with UE, Bill? He asks. I'm not with them. I'm the inventor, one of the inventors. They sent me because nobody else seems to be able to explain it. Terry nods several times. Excuse me, he takes two aspirin. So, it's God in a box. What does that mean exactly? Okay, says Bill. The basic idea is that God is immanent in certain objects. Like, for instance, the best example is the Ark of the Covenant. I don't know if you're familiar with the story of Uzzah in the second book of Samuel. Remind me. Maybe I better start farther back. See, the Ark was like a box made of wood, about 4 feet by 2 by 2. It was supposed to have the tables of the law in it, you know, the ones that God gave to Moses. Oh, yeah. You saw the movie, right? Okay, that makes it a little easier. Well, the story goes they're moving the ark in a cart, and this Uzzah sees it's about to tip over, so he puts his hand on it, like, to steady it, and he gets a charge of something that kills him. This box is something that kills people, Bill? Terry asks. He takes two more aspirin. No, that's only if you get too big a jolt, like electricity. Anyway, what got us thinking, it says in the Bible the ark was covered inside and out with gold. Now, there could be two reasons for that. One, gold is a precious metal, okay? You're right there, Bill. What's the other reason? The other reason is, Bill leans forward confidentially, gold is a good conductor. Not just a good conductor, a great conductor. So we said, What if there is something in holy objects that could be electronically enhanced or, you know, throttled down if it's too strong? The first thing we tried was a really old set of the scrolls, the Torah. Bingo. Furthermore, we found out you can transfer this power by leaving your holy object in a lead-lined container with some other object. For a relic, like a piece of bone, say, we use bone. Lamb is the best. That's unbelievable, Bill. I know. That's the problem. All I can do is I can let you try yourself. May I ask what your religion is, Terry? I'm a Presbyterian. Okay, you get the Protestant model. For that, we had to go to old Bibles. We bought a Gutenberg, and maybe you think that didn't cost. We found out later the Wycliffe is just as good. Bill is taking a small black box out of the suitcase. He lays it on the desk, and Terry looks at it. On the left is a dial, and on the right, inset in the box, a disc of some off-white material. Bill plugs it in. A red light comes on. Now, what you do is you just relax and put your fingers on this ceramic plate and then slowly turn up the gain. This is a low imminent circuit, so you don't have to worry. Go ahead. Terry does as he is told. The ceramic plate is cool and slick under his fingers. He turns the dial with his other hand. I don't feel a thing. You got it all the way up? That's funny. Bill pulls the box towards him. Let's try the theometer. He takes a bright little instrument from among the ballpoint pens in his shirt pocket, lays it across the ceramic plate. The digital readout stays at zero. Dead, says Bill. He opens the case and peers inside. Okay, here's the trouble. It blew a resistor. He pulls out a little cylinder and shows it to Terry. In the box, nestled among wires and ugly electrical parts, is a Gideon Bible. This is a prototype, Bill says, still a few bugs in it. The production model will have all printed circuits. He gropes in his suitcase, finds another resistor and puts it in, closes the case, try it again. Terry puts his fingers on the ceramic plate, turns the dial up. Almost at once, a feeling of indescribable peace comes over him. He no longer cares about Bill's haircut or Ollie's t-shirts. The throbbing at the back of his head goes away. See? See? Says Bill, exposing his mediocre dentistry. Bill leaves the machine with Terry. Terry calls in Lori and Reggie and swears them to silence. Over the next 3 days, they rough out a campaign. It is terrific. The client is impressed. Terry gets a bonus. The fall campaign is a success. Holiness for instant tranquility, the peace that passes understanding at the touch of a button in the privacy of your own home. Hospitals buy the professional model at $17.95. Psychiatrists buy it. The home models retail for $6.95 plus tax. People line up for it in department stores. It comes in Protestant, Catholic, Orthodox, and Reformed versions. For the overseas market, Buddhist, Muslim, and Hindu versions are on the drawing boards. Church and synagogue attendance zooms, then nosedives, until pastors begin allowing worshipers to bring their holy nexuses. An enterprising minister in the East Village announces plans to build them into the backs of pews. Labor unrest is down. Gross national product is up. Bunny is happy. Ollie is happy. Terry is not happy. There are persistent rumors that Bill's partner, the other inventor, is confined to a mental institution where he performs miracles of healing but has to be anchored to a bed to keep him from floating away. Yesterday, the day before Christmas, Terry saw a man levitating up the stairway of the IRT at 50th Street. A week ago, he found himself speaking in Japanese, a language he does not know, to a Puerto Rican waiter in a restaurant. For the past several days, Terry has been bleeding slightly from the palms of his hands. This morning, when he left the apartment, his wife asked him, "When will you be home?"
"Verily, I know not," Terry answered. Now he is up on the parapet of the agency building, looking down at Third Avenue, from which the strains of Away in a Manger arise. He knows that in a moment he will spread his arms and step off. Will he fly? This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.